Support for the World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
The difference between walking while black in Jamaica and here, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Garnett Cadogan is a writer from Jamaica. He loved to walk there. Then he moved to New Orleans.
You develop these rules. I don't run at night. I don't wear a hoodie. I'd have nothing that looks metallic or sharp in my hand at night.
Plus, an imam in Dallas says last week's shootings in the U.S. are a wake-up call for all Americans.
We don't want the legacy that we pass on to our next generation to be one of violence and hatred and extremism and bigotry. We want to be the generation that figure things out.
And what they're saying in Egypt about the shootings in America.
Charges of hypocrisy. These attacks are almost celebrated in Egyptian media.
Those stories, plus being black and Caucasian in Russia, ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thank you for being with us on this Wednesday. Black Lives Matter formed as a response to police brutality and the killings of black men by police and others. The movement first came together in the wake of the 2012 shooting death of Trayvon Martin and the subsequent trial. But Trayvon Martin was not the first case, nor, as we know, was it the last. Now, imagine you're black, but not from here. You're from Jamaica, for example, and there, when your parents gave you the talk, it was mostly about not staying out too late in the streets of Kingston.
By the time I was in my mid-teens, I became an incessant walker, and I couldn't think of driving when I could walk there because there's too much to be discovered, too much to be found, too much delight on the streets.
That's Garnett Cadogan. He's a writer from Kingston, Jamaica. His beautiful essay titled Walking While Black shows you how the simple act of going out in America can be weighted down with risk if you're a person of color. Walking in Kingston, Jamaica was meditative for Cadogan, quite the opposite he found when he went to college in New Orleans.
I was crossing the street to get back to my university after an activity, one of those welcoming activities that they had for new students. Mm-hmm. And there's a gentleman in a wheelchair and stuck in a pothole on the crosswalk. And so I offered to push the wheelchair and to give him assistance, at which point he threatened to shoot me in the face and exploded. And I thought maybe there was something in the way maybe I was too presumptuous, or perhaps I wasn't understood because of my accent. And so I might have said one thing and he heard another, only for me to see him turn immediately and ask someone who was white to then help him across the street.
Wow. What was that like? I mean, you'd come from Jamaica. Was this the first time anything like that had happened to you?
Yes.
What was that like then?
Well, I'd initially registered it as just him being grumpy and my complexion not being to his taste. But then soon after I began seeing other signs, people crossing the street and clutching their bags or walking in, the police pulling up saying that they got a complaint that someone suspicious was around. Or I'd be walking and someone would be two or three paces ahead of me and they turn around and saw me and then started speeding up, or they'd cross the street, or you know, they'd get into a quick jog, or on a few occasions, quick sprint.
Mm-hmm.
And so I recognized the way I would treat dangerous people when I was growing up in Jamaica was the way people began treating me.
How did you adjust to that here in the States? Like, what kind of things did you start doing to compensate?
I sort of did the inverse of what a lot of my women friends did, that the way the streets could be hostile to them, that they were continually the subject of sexual attention, unwanted sexual attention. And they would try to, as it were, put on, you know, their bravest, toughest face. I would try to do the inverse, try to seem as approachable, as safe. So everything from my sartorial choices that the collegiate wear, whether it be khaki pants with, let's say, a nice gingham shirt and, you know, jacket over it along with, you know, Oxford laced shoes, to wearing, you know, things with my college name on it so they could see, oh, he's a college student here. And to even the pace at which I move, to even crossing the street to make you feel more comfortable so you didn't need to cross nor pick up your cell phone to call the cops.
Right. Aside from the Clark's Desert boots you mentioned, which were pretty popular in Kingston, I mean, you were dressing like a preppy. You were kind of putting on a costume. Did you feel bad doing that?
Yes, there are times in which I began asking the question, who am I really? And to what extent am I changing myself? What kind of performance am I putting on? And, you know, where do I end and where does someone else begin? And to what extent am I going to go to make others feel safe? And of course, some of it was in self-interest. Sometimes I'm making them feel safe because I want to be safe also, because I know the appearance of me as a threat also threatens me. The more you feel afraid of me, is the more likely you'll be to call the cops on me, the more likely I will be in handcuffs and have NOPD, who weren't the warmest people.
That's New Orleans Police Department.
Mildly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
that's putting it mildly.
Right.
It's the more likely I'll be detained and harassed and bullied or even beat up by them, which has happened.
Did that ever happen to you in New Orleans?
Oh, yes.
With the police?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It was pretty remarkable reading your essay, because I've spent lots of time walking in Kingston and New Orleans and New York City, where you also went. And I was suddenly aware of my white privilege, you know, because this is stuff that doesn't occur to me, at least not in most neighborhoods. You were stopped by the police in New York. You left New Orleans and moved north. What happened in that instance?
Well, I've had a few times, but I think you're speaking of instance in the essay where I speak of running.
Yes.
And a police aimed his gun at me and asked me to stop. And
this was after people had said, you know, you might not want to run at night because you're a black man and that might draw suspicion.
Yes. And I inculcated these rules that I don't run at night, I don't wear a hoodie, I'd have nothing that looks metallic or sharp in my hand at night. So you develop these rules. In America, they call it the talk, in which parents of black children will say, here are the rules with which you need to abide by once you're in public space to make sure that you're safe. And I had to cobble these rules together because I never had to think about these rules growing up in Jamaica. But I thought somehow in New York that I had to be less conscious of these rules, that it was a more open, a more safe, a much more pluralistic environment. So I was running. It was my birthday celebration and some friends had just had dinner with me, and I was on my way to meet some other friends to see a concert. And as I began to run, out of nowhere came a police officer with a gun pointed at me and pulled me over to his car. And in no time, there were handcuffs on me. There was a swarm of police officers around me asking so many questions at once I could hardly focus or think. So I did as I've done before, to look and see and guess who'd be most likely to hit me or to harass me the most.
It's a very conscious kind of process that goes through your mind, it sounds like.
Yes. So I look and I think, oh, well, there are seven. You know, who looks like they'll be most likely to inflict blows? Answer that person first and make sure that in answering, that everything from your tone of voice to your body language, everything suggests passiveness, everything suggests compliance. Nothing, not the least thing, can be assumed to be defiance. Make sure that you don't say, why am I being stopped? You say, what did I do, officer? And so I began answering, and eventually someone came up and put his hand on my back and said, you know, he's not sweating. And apparently someone had committed a crime. According to them, someone had committed a crime, but it was hours earlier, about three blocks. So apparently that must be the slowest runner, or somehow they assumed he was hiding and then suddenly decided to make a run for it.
Right.
But then one police officer commented at how fast my heart was beating. And I said nothing, but I thought to myself, I'm surrounded by at least a dozen cops, maybe two dozen. Of course my heart is going to race.
Right.
I mean, handcuffs, you know, you're digging through my pockets. I've been pushed and dragged around and asked a million questions. Yes, I do get nervous. My heart is racing, not out of guilt. My heart is racing out of fear.
How exhausting and emotionally taxing is this all the time?
It varies. It's at once exhausting, but, and this may be the more dangerous thing, or the more troubling thing rather, that you get accustomed to it, that you inculcate these rules, you teach yourself a certain way of moving in public, of moving in public space, a certain way of responding to law enforcement, for instance, a certain way of trying to control for other people's fears, that it sometimes becomes automatic. But then other times it becomes exhausting, especially if you're in an environment where you don't have to do this. So for instance, when I go home to visit home in Jamaica and I return, the first few weeks, it's a for want of a better term, reverse culture shock. Because I'm now once again in an environment where I have to think, oh, you're a threat to many people because of your race. You have to begin making these adjustments. You have to play a mind reader, which is a dangerous thing because sometimes someone is avoiding you because you're a man. It's the middle of the night and a woman is concerned about her safety. She's not avoiding you because you're black. She's avoiding you because you're a man and she's used to being the object of harassment. But then again, you can't not try to anticipate the way people would think of you as a threat, because then becoming too at ease can have tragic consequences.
Garnett, walking began for you as a way of asserting your independence in Kingston. What has your experience here in the United States walking done to your enjoyment of walking?
For me, it's still the most remarkable way of moving through the world. And it's a way of independence, it's freedom, it's exploration, discovery. But it still feels like a joy cut short, a delight squeezed, enjoyment clipped. You know, you'd like to be singing in the rain, but instead you're hunching your back and hoping not to get washed away.
Garnett Cadogan, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Garnett Cadogan is a writer from Kingston, Jamaica. He now lives in Charlottesville, Virginia. We have a link to Garnett's full essay, Walking While Black, up at PRI.org. It's definitely worth your time. Garnett definitely gave us a lot to consider there, so we're going to step back for a sec. Here's some new music from an older soul, saxophonist Idris Akamore and his band The Pyramids. There actually is a relevant backstory to this music of Idris Akamore and The Pyramids. The band formed at Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio in the early 70s, fusing African roots with spiritual music, jazz, and Sun Ra-like space jams, but they broke up in 1977 until some 30-plus years later when demand for their music, especially among European jazz fans, pushed them back together. This band's new album is called We Be All Africans, and as Akamore himself explained, it's a message of survival. We need one another to survive on this planet that we all share.
Memory. Feeling you close to me. Now you're gone from my life. From my life, you're still here in my life.
A quick look ahead before the break. Russia and Ukraine don't see eye to eye on much of anything these days, but they seem willing to put conflict aside when it comes to making TV shows.
When all of this happened, there was such a big, you know, kick in the butt. Even the smallest production company is now filled with, you know, orders.
Politics, though, can make for tricky casting.
Four of the five top names of people that we said, you know, they'd be great for this role were, they spoke out too much, you know, anti-Ukraine. And then the one top Ukrainian guy we wanted, he spoke out too much, you know, anti-Russian.
Getting shows like The Sniffer and Good Cop, Bad Cop from script to the small screen, that's coming up in a bit. Stick around. You're with The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ, or Curious Quotient, through the game of lifelong learning. Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Last week, lawmakers in Egypt were among the many expressing outrage at the police shootings here in the U.S. They said Washington had lost its credibility on human rights. Well, not sure if those lawmakers considered Egypt's own human rights record before making that statement. Today, Amnesty International issued a scathing report on the way the Egyptian government deals with its opponents. Noor Youssef is a reporter with the New York Times. She's in Cairo. First, tell us how the news of the recent police shootings in the U.S. How has this news been received in Egypt?
The way the news was received in Egypt is typical of Egyptian media. They have is adverses on gloating. Actually, there is a very condescending tone in the reporting. They immediately blame officials and then draw contrasts between how international media covers the stories in the U.S. and how they cover the stories in Egypt and say they've been unfair and they've been overly critical and that they have no legs to stand on and they shouldn't criticize the Egyptian government.
So charges of hypocrisy on the United States, but now we've got this Amnesty International report out about Egypt's own human rights record. What does it say?
What the report says, it speaks about the latest method deployed by security agents in Egypt to silence critics, which is to enforce disappearances, which is when state security agents detain a person, deny them access to lawyers, to their families in an undisclosed location, and usually even publicly deny that they've arrested the person. And usually what happens in enforced disappearances is the person would show up later in a morgue or show up later in an official detention center with charges. That could take months or weeks or a few days.
As far as this Amnesty International report goes, asserting that Egypt is torturing and disappearing people, how have lawmakers and politicians in Egypt reacted to that?
So far, the Egyptian Foreign Ministry came out signing the report and again renewing its accusations that they are biased. Lawmakers in Egypt tend to support that line as well.
Now, there have been several cases that have been held up as examples. The 14-year-old boy who was thought to be part of the Muslim Brotherhood, raped and tortured for his confession by officials. He was disappeared, but now is awaiting a trial. There's also an Italian student who was found dead by the roadside. Is there one story, though, that seems to more widely represent what this report is alleging?
Essentially, every individual that enters the political sphere in Egypt and is not within the government camp strictly is exposed to this risk. And many of them have suffered as a result.
Is it so widespread that even you know someone whose family member or friend has been disappeared?
Yes, I know at least 4 people who've been disappeared. Families and friends go and they're given no answers constantly by security officers in police stations. They're told, you know, we don't know where they are, and essentially given the runaround. They show no interest in actually investigating reports of disappearances.
What risk is there to a family making those charges or even investigating or, you know, asking questions about those charges?
Quite high. For the families of the disappeared or the detained, the risks have been are becoming increasingly higher. There are instances where lawyers who went to ask to make official inquiries about those who have been forcibly disappeared were forcibly disappeared themselves. But the risks are high. Same goes for reporters. Yes. So you have.
So if you asked the Egyptian public, would they agree with the broad contours of this report that the Egyptian government is abusing and disappearing its citizens in the name of security?
They would agree in private, definitely, not publicly, because naturally they fear for their lives. It's not a small segment of society that is supportive of the government right now, because they still hope President Sisi can turn things around and give them the stability that they have been missing for the past 5 years. So some would look at this as the price for that pursuit of stability, and this is better than becoming Syria or becoming Libya or seeing, you know, armed conflict on the streets, because that's the alternative that the government tells them they have.
Noor Youssef, a reporter with the New York Times in Cairo, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You may not know the name of our next guest, but you've heard about Abdullah Maflahi. He's the owner of the Baton Rouge convenience store where, on July 5th, white police officers shot and killed a black man, Alton Sterling. Maflahi is a Muslim born in Yemen. He was raised in the Detroit area and went to Baton Rouge to open a business, the Triple S Food Mart, in 2010. He knew the Sterling family. They were customers. He says Alton Sterling was a regular.
He had a big heart. He always gave back to the community. He always tried to help anybody that was short on some things that they wanted to buy. He would walk in there and pay the rest. He was a very friendly guy.
Maflahi used his cell phone to record what would become known as the second video of Sterling's death. He watched a horrible scene play out in front of his store and then saw police officers coming for him.
They threw me in the back of a cop car for almost 4 hours.
It would be a very long night.
It was hot. The seat was hot. And when I asked them that I needed to use the bathroom, a cop escorted me to behind a building, one of the neighboring buildings, and told me to go there while people were walking to go see what was going on in front of the store. A lot of people thought I had got arrested and I had something to do with it.
Muflahi says police kept him locked in the squad car, then took him to headquarters for questioning. By the time he returned to his store, police tape was on the door and he was not allowed to go in. He says the police did not show him a search warrant, and he says they took the surveillance video equipment that would have captured the entire incident beginning to finish. Now Muflahi is suing the Baton Rouge police officers who detained him, along with the police department and the city of Baton Rouge.
Well, they violated my rights. I was just a witness to a horrible scene where it left me traumatized and kind of emotionally unstable.
Muflahi, with his attorney, released his cell phone video a day later. It's been seen tens of thousands of times and drawn a lot of attention, some of it pretty abusive, referring to the Dallas shootings of police officers.
They're just blaming me. A lot of people were blaming me for what happened in Texas. Like, what happened in Dallas was because of the Muslim in Baton Rouge. And it's very even hard to even kind of repeat everything they have been saying about me.
He says he has stopped looking at social media entirely.
You know, I'm scared of all this coming back on me, retribution, and I feel like somebody might come back and hurt me or hurt my family. Business has been kind of hurt, and it's really messed up my life a little bit.
He is getting support from his customers, though. That includes Alton Sterling's aunt, Sandra Sterling. She has asked Abdullah Muflahi to speak at her nephew's funeral on Friday. We reached out to Baton Rouge authorities for their side of the story. Parish attorney Leanne Batson responded with an email. She wrote, "We have a policy of not commenting on pending litigation." News headlines are next, and then a little later, what we lost when the Father Teresa of Pakistan died on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Big changes at 10 Downing Street today. David Cameron moved out. Theresa May moved in. But through it all, there's Larry the cat.
We kind of take a lot of pictures of Larry doing what he does best, which is like lounging around and kind of looking quizzically at ministers as they enter and leave. So, I'm very pro-Larry.
Larry's story, that's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Last week, Philando Castile was shot by a police officer outside St. Paul, Minnesota, during a traffic stop. But before that, Castile had already been stopped 31 times while driving. It's an example of what many Americans refer to as driving while black. Not sure if there's an equivalent of that in Russia, and if there is, you could probably call it driving while Caucasian. But it's not what you think. I asked reporter Charles Maines in Moscow to explain how Russians talk about ethnicity.
There's a focus on ethnicity here that even doesn't matter what your passport is in a way. There's a sense that, you know, even if it's a Russian Jew, you're a Jew. If you're Russian, you're Russian, Ruski. And if you are Chechen kid from, say, Grozny, you know, you are Chechen, but sometimes the derogatory term, and it's not polite company by any means, is to refer to some of these people from that region of the country as being Chorny, as black.
So say a doctoral student from Nigeria shows up in Moscow. How are they treated? How are they referred to?
Well, you know, it's funny because, I mean, Russia, of course, during the Soviet period, Russia was very active in Africa. And in some ways, Africa was split between the U.S. and the Soviet Union in terms of spheres of influence. So, for example, in the south of Moscow, there is what's now called the People's Friendship University, used to be called Patrice Lumumba University. You had many Africans come here to study. They got a good education. Many of them stayed, married into families, some still call that part of town Africaville. So, you know, you have people here, but at the same time, you know, the Soviet Union, the Russians today have this kind of aversion to what they think is sort of American imposed political correctness. On the other hand, if you look back to the Soviet period, in some ways, some of these Soviet ideals of, comrades from different countries, everyone getting along, if you're from the working class, and that formed its own sense of kind of a wallpaper around some of these issues, and that's what kept people from, essentially attacking one another. And unfortunately, in Russia today, we see more and more violence against migrants, violence against people of color. I certainly have friends who are from Africa or from the United States who've come here, studied or worked, and had a tough time.
For Russians who've traveled outside Russia to places where black is not someone who comes from Chechnya or the Caucasus, do they have a problem with these classifications?
Well, I just remember when I was a student here and I had a classmate who was an African-American guy from Baltimore, a friend of mine still. And I remember we went to this little town outside of Moscow. And okay, this was several years ago and maybe things have changed. But I do remember this kind of ring just forming around us as we walked around the town and people wanting to come up and touch him. I mean, it was like being from outer space.
Wow. What about you? I mean, as an American, how do you react to these references?
Well, I've kind of learned to take some of the nuance, I guess. I think part of the thing to keep in mind is that everything's a bit confused now because certainly Russians who are from, major cities certainly understand that, for example, that a lot of Americans or African-Americans and white Americans like myself get a little offended when we hear negra, which they take to mean negro, but of course we might hear it as being something close to the N-word. And so some of them will use chorny as like a substitute, thinking that they're doing the right thing and calling you, saying essentially black. But in the wider Russian context, it has a negative connotation, if you still follow me.
I also want to ask you whether it's kind of prompted like major questions about the purpose of any labels.
Well, I think it's true, but Russians like labels. I mean, they don't shy away from them. And I think there's, again, a sense that kind of this American political correctness goes too far. And so I think even in some ways, the way you see the reactions here to the U.S. shootings kind of reflect that to a certain degree.
So, Charles, what's been the reaction in Moscow to everything that's been going on here in the States?
Well, I mean, if you look back to, the shootings in Orlando, for example, there was kind of an outpouring of people laid flowers at the American embassy here in Moscow, and people certainly voiced a lot of support, and Russians have suffered from terrorism as well. It's a big issue. But there's also ideology and there's also Kremlin politics, and certainly you've seen ways that some of America's racial tragedies have become kind of fodder for Russian state TV. There's a sense that, what's bad for America is good for Russia, a little bit of kind of, we feel your pain, but, they acknowledge that racism exists.
Reporter Charles Maines, always great to get your take from Moscow. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Next door to Russia in Ukraine, there's still occasional fighting between government troops and rebels backed by Moscow. That's despite ongoing efforts to hammer out a peace deal. In fact, there hasn't been much good news coming out of Ukraine since the conflict there began back in 2014. And there's a good deal of pessimism about where the country is headed. But there is one big industry in Ukraine that's thriving now. And no, it's not the weapons business. I'll let Alina Simone explain.
When it comes to sanctions, Russia is known for its tit-for-tat approach. But a weird thing happened when Ukraine banned all TV content created in Russia after 2014. Russia didn't impose the same ban on Ukraine. Instead, they started buying Ukrainian TV shows like crazy.
When all of this happened, there was such a big kick in the butt. Volume-wise, everything is growing. Even the smallest production company is now filled with orders.
This is Irina Kostyuk, a producer at Film UA, the Ukrainian company behind Russia's hottest detective series. The Sniffer, about a cop who dissects crimes using his olfactory superpowers. Traditionally, the Russian and Ukrainian TV industries have been intertwined, in large part because most primetime shows are still shot in Russian, not Ukrainian. Even the ones in Ukraine. Here's James Kramer, former vice president of Sony Pictures Russia.
Before the political conflict, Russia and Ukraine had been even closer than the U.S. and Canada, especially in terms of television, where there was production on both sides and actors went back and forth and all the creative and technical people. So it was really more or less one market.
But the Ukrainian TV industry was still heavily dependent on Russia.
And that caused a kind of interesting problem because probably 80 to 85% of what the programs that were on Ukrainian primetime television were Russian produced.
Which means when the Ukrainian government decided to ban new Russian shows, Russia lost a huge buyer.
So they've just lost really probably more than 50% of their profit by Ukrainians saying, we're not going to help the Russian economy by buying their TV shows anymore. So that has changed the market tremendously in Russia, as has the devaluation of the ruble. And that's why production has been frozen for the better part of the last 2 years.
It also meant there was a huge void of new TV content now on both sides. Russia, because it couldn't afford to produce new shows. Ukraine, because they'd mostly just been buying Russia's shows. One of the creators who stepped into that void was James, who now runs his own production company in Los Angeles. He and a Russian writer are developing new shows for Ukrainian television.
So we sold one, and we've now sold a couple of others.
What he didn't anticipate was that Russia would start buying his shows from Ukraine.
Suddenly, they have a need for new material as well. So they're now buying Russian language productions from Ukraine to air in Russia. And that's what's happening with our first series called Lahoy Khoroshi Mient, which means bad cop, good cop.
It's a reversal of fortune that no one had anticipated. But Irina points out, even though there's a lot more demand, there's a lot less money available for the average production, like half as much. And
our lawmaking system, they impose more and more bans.
Bans on displaying any kind of Russian or Soviet military insignia, and bans on a long list of Russian actors, writers, and directors who have ever spoken out against Ukraine.
So you have a list of like about 170 people. And if one person appeared in like one maybe episode of a whole series, I don't know, walking just on the background and somewhere, this whole series is banned.
And new shows like Bad Cop, Good Cop have to be careful not to run afoul of those rules.
Because it will be shown in both Ukraine and Russia, and it's a cop show, they've created neutral uniforms. So the uniforms are neither Russian nor Ukrainian. And the money is all dollars. So it's not hryvnia, it's not rubles.
They also weren't able to cast many of the actors they wanted.
Probably four of the five top names of people that we said, you know, they'd be great for this role were, they spoke out too much, you know, anti-Ukraine. And then the one top Ukrainian guy we wanted, he spoke out too much anti-Russian.
See, Russia has its own entertainment industry blacklist. So I ask Irina, what happens if Russia changes its mind and decides to ban new Ukrainian shows too?
Oh, we're sitting on the edge of our seats because anytime they have the right to. Ethically, why not?
But even if Russia imposes its own ban, the divorce has still provided Ukraine's TV industry with an important jolt toward independence.
It's a bit of our fault as well. We should have been thinking about it way before it, and we shouldn't be so connected to the Russian market. In a way, it is good.
The TV industry in Ukraine, making lemonade from the crisis. For The World, this is Alina Simone.
This next story starts with a headline that ran in newspapers in Pakistan last Saturday. It was a quote that read, "No religion is higher than humanity." Now, that quote is well known in Pakistan, and many there could tell you they're the words of Abdul Sattar Eidi. He died last week at the age of 88. Abdul Sattar Eidi was a philanthropist, but he was born impoverished. And when there was bad news in Pakistan, a bombing, an armed attack, Eidi would often be on the scene helping out, trying to raise funds for the victims and their families. My BBC colleague Mobeen Azhar joins us. It's kind of difficult to sum up a life in a few words. You tweeted, Eidi was a real-life saint, a huge loss for Pakistan and for the world. Tell us how his life's work began.
You know, we often use phrases like saint, but in this context, I think it's actually well-deserved. His life began in Gujarat in India, and he came over to what became Pakistan after partition. And it was early on in his life when he was still young, in 1951, that he started raising money for charity. He wanted to set up a clinic and an ambulance service. And back then, it was one man's. So it was a young man who would literally ask people for money and say that taking care of people is our duty. So we need to put our money together and we need to buy a vehicle that can be used as an ambulance. Keep in mind, the state does not provide ambulances. So he started this in 1951. If you fast forward to the 80s, it became acknowledged that he had built the largest ambulance service in the world.
Wow.
It's a mean feat.
It's extraordinary because he was an impoverished kid. He finds his way to this. What motivated him to this selfless position in life?
it was all about what he would call humanity. You know, as you said, there's this quote, there is no religion higher than humanity. I remember him saying as well, it's well known, he said, it's everyone's responsibility to take care of each other. That's what being human is. And, you know, I met him many times and he would say this again and again, that being human is all about taking care of each other. You know, it didn't just extend, his welfare foundation didn't just extend to an ambulance service. They also had orphanages, they had hospitals, they had clinics. His work was amazing.
So he came to be known as the Father Teresa of Pakistan, kind of a one-man welfare system. Also, philosophically, he had a kind of just very plain and simple ideas. Here's a short clip of Edie, just talking about the cornerstones of his philosophy. And what he's saying there, Mobeen, is simplicity, honesty, hard work, and punctuality. This is the key to our success. Pretty incredible.
Completely.
He changed
completely.
Your life because you followed him around for 3 months making a documentary about him and saw him up close working with children. What did he do to your life?
I did, yeah. I spent 3 months with him at one of his orphanages, and it was an amazing experience. It was amazing to see, you know, how he took care of people and how simple he was. He had a very small office. He would literally have two outfits and two pairs of sandals that he would wear all the time. And he would make a note of telling people that he didn't want them giving him clothes or giving him riches. This is a man, you know, politically, he's very astute as well, because this is a man who government after government in Pakistan would offer him sponsorship and they'd want to build political allegiances with him. And he turned them down. One Wow. after another, he said he didn't want to be sponsored. It was impossible, just on a personal level. It was impossible to be in his presence and not have to think about what we as individuals are contributing to the world and how we can make the world a better place. That was his entire mission in life. And I think everyone around him was really forced to think about how they could improve things too.
For a man who kind of is known for his quote, no religion is higher than humanity, how was he viewed by extremists?
Interestingly enough, you know, many of the extremists in Pakistan and the TTP, the Tehrik-e-Taliban, Pakistani Taliban, had threatened him, actually. They'd said that his work was undermining some of what they would call their humanitarian work. And so that might sound really, really strange, but it's because he was a hugely unifying figure. He cut through any kind of religious extremism. In fact, he cut through religion full stop. I remember sitting with him once, and it was prayer time on a Friday. And I assumed he would go to Friday prayers. And I said to him, do you need to go? Because we were mid-conversation. And he said, well, you know, I pray when I can. I think it's better to take care of people than spend your whole life praying. I remember that really made me smile. And it really, really kind of summed up to me what his priorities were. He thought people were much more important than any kind of organized religion.
My BBC colleague Mobeen Azhar in London, thanks so much for telling us about Abdul Sattar Edie. Really appreciate it.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Still to come on the show, speaking alongside Barack Obama and George W. Bush yesterday in Dallas, an imam. We'll meet him next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. At yesterday's interfaith memorial service for the five police officers slain last week in Dallas, President Obama once again became the nation's preacher in chief. He quoted from the Bible, telling Americans they must pray for a new heart, not a heart of stone, he said, but a heart open to the fears and hopes and challenges of our fellow citizens. Also on that stage in Dallas was Imam Omar Suleiman.
We choose today to live by the hope that you've instilled within us, not the fears that others manufacture amongst us. And with that, we pray to you, the one God of Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, and us all, for one Dallas, one America, and one world.
Suleiman is an imam at the Valley Ranch Islamic Center outside of Dallas. Omar Suleiman, thanks for being on the show again. You were invoking the three major monotheistic religions in your few minutes that you had on the stage. What did you want to tell people?
My message, and I think the message of my colleagues in the faith community and others as well, was that no matter what faith you come from or where you stand on the current tensions in the United States, this is not the path that we want to go down. We do not want to go down a path of a civil war, or, you know, and I mean that in a broader sense. Mm. I don't mean an actual civil war, but we don't want to go down this path of constant violence. And I believe this was the 11th or 12th time the president has had to attend one of these gatherings and ceremonies. And sadly, it's become the norm as opposed to the exception. My message was that God has placed within all of us a sense of mercy and justice and compassion and hope. And he has honored all of us as human beings. And we need to honor that common humanity, you know, as opposed to boxing ourselves into things that will continue to perpetuate the divides in our society.
That was your message. Other than standing behind two U.S. presidents and first ladies, what struck you from that service?
Believe it or not, what struck me was the absolute silence. There wasn't a single person. This might sound odd, but in our day and age, you know, everyone's taking pictures, everyone's, you know, got their cameras out, whatever social media outlet they're using. But the absolute silence of everybody in the room, everyone's eyes were focused on the podium. Everyone was deeply immersed in the spirit of hope that we embodied in that ceremony and in that gathering.
Does that silence suggest that your message, the messages that were expressed yesterday, were heard?
Well, to be honest with you, and I may be biased, but I mean, I thought that that was one of the best presidential addresses that we've heard in the last 8 years. I think that President Obama struck a very important tone of balance and healing the rifts that exist in our society. He didn't run away from them. He addressed them, but he still remained absolutely respectful to our five fallen officers and their families and to the occasion that gathered us that day. I think that every, you know, all the words that were said were along a common tone. This was, you know, an opportunity for us to demonstrate that we can come together to reject violence and hatred and bigotry, that we can remain very passionate about our causes and continue to protest the status quo. But we should not become disagreeable, and we should not allow that to fester to where violence would actually come out of some of the words that we say. So I think it's a call for us to be more responsible with our rhetoric. It's a call for us to recognize that we are handing a legacy to a new generation of Americans that looks very different from ours. And we don't want the legacy that we pass on to our next generation to be one of violence and hatred and extremism and bigotry. We want to be the generation that figure things out. We don't want them to be the generation that looks back at our generation and says, you know, what were these guys doing?
Was it hard to reconcile your taking part in a movement, Black Lives Matter, protesting police brutality, and participating in the service for the fallen police officers?
Absolutely not. I mean, I felt no conflict, and I do sincerely mean that. Because again, my protesting was not against the police. My protesting was against police brutality. It was to come together, just as we came together, to say that the taking of the life of Alton Sterling or anyone else who's had their lives lost to police brutality, just as we came together to say that enough is enough, and it's unacceptable that the children of those men will no longer have their father. We came together to say that it's unacceptable that these police officers were taken and their children will no longer have their father and their families will be forever devastated. And what I said in the beginning of my prayer is that as a city of Dallas, we were heartbroken, but as a country, we're soul searching. And I truly do believe that this is a pivotal moment in the history of our country as we try to search for the very soul of this country.
Omar Suleiman, an imam at the Valley Ranch Islamic Center outside Dallas. Thank you very much. Good to have you on the program again.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Finally today, the changing of the guard, so to speak, in Britain. Theresa May is in as prime minister, David Cameron out. Literally out of the place that's been his home for the past 6 years. Today, Cameron and his family left the prime minister's official residence at 10 Downing Street in London for the last time. But one member of the household is staying, Larry the Cat. Seems his job at 10 Downing isn't over yet.
Downing Street has, for quite a long time, had a bit of a rat problem. So it was decided by the staff there that they wanted to get a cat after much debate. Larry came along from Battersea Cats and Dogs Home. So that's kind of the background of how he got there. And his title is Chief Mouse Catcher.
That's Steve Jones, social media editor for the UK's Press Association. He says at this point, when there's a media call outside the Prime Minister's home, Larry is a familiar sight.
Whenever the press descend on Downing Street for big events, Larry, you know, likes to sort of bask in the attention. You can often see him sort of playing up for the cameras. So there's always a lot of interest in Larry.
Fair to say more interest in him than David Cameron. Now, there'd been some rumors that Cameron didn't like Larry, or conversely, that he might take the cat with him. But today, speaking to British lawmakers for the last time as Prime Minister, Cameron sought to reassure the nation about Larry.
Sadly, I can't take Larry with me. He belongs to the House and the staff love him very much, as do I.
Cameron even showed off a photo of him with Larry. Steve Jones of the Press Association says the outgoing Prime Minister later posted that photo on social media.
I think it'd be quite telling for a Prime Minister in the 21st century for their final act to be posting a cat picture on Facebook.
Yep, sure would. And by the way, in case you're wondering, Jones is a fan of this cat.
I think Larry should stay. Obviously, I'm very pro-Larry. We take a lot of photos of Larry as the Press Association, the news agency for the UK. We kind of take a lot of pictures of Larry doing what he does best, which is like lounging around and kind of looking quizzically at ministers as they enter and leave. So, I'm very pro-Larry.
So unlike the other residents of 10 Downing Street who are Brexiting, Larry the cat will remain. And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Catch you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.